Over the last two decades, India has gone through a series of major political and economic transformations. How it manages those changes and the ones to come will have profound impact on nearly the sixth of the world's population that lives there, but also on the rest of us. And we're joined now by The Economist Adam Roberts. His special report on India called Aim Higher can be found in the most recent issue of his magazine. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
Annual economic growth in India is down to roughly 5%. Isn't that still relatively high compared to most of the rest of the world right now? Wouldn't Western leaders be elated to announce that their economies had grown at 5% last year?
Yeah, you're spot on. If we were sitting and talking about Greece or Ireland or France or almost anywhere in the world, 5% would sound great. But what you have to consider is that in India, you've got a fast-growing population, you've got a very poor country that has a lot of catch-up, a lot of catching-up growth to do. It's a long way behind other developing emerging economies like China or Brazil. And so in this country, if we're down to 5% growth, that begins to feel almost like a recession here. And, you know, we've been used in India to having 8%, 9%, even nearly 10% growth. So a slowdown to 5% feels pretty bad.
Foreign investment in India has dropped 67% this year. Why has there been such a dramatic decrease?
I think a lot of people have lost confidence right now in India's policymakers. There's doubts that politicians, bureaucrats, whether the ruling party or the opposition, nobody's really ready to grasp the nettle and do the economic reforms that outsiders and domestic investors both want to see. We've seen some recent efforts to change, but all in all, Indians don't look really ready to take another round of quite painful economic reforms of the sort that got the economy going 20 years ago.
Has economic growth across India been uneven? Are certain of its states faring better than others?
Absolutely. So you've got a massive, diverse economy where some of the states like Gujarat, Maharashtra, Tamil Nadu, these states often in the west of India or the south of India doing much better. But then you go up to the northern states, the northeast, where there's deep poverty. I used to be the Africa correspondent for The Economist, and I've seen equally bad poverty in northern India, just as bad as I ever saw in Africa. So you've got huge diversity. Some of the richest people in the world, $60 billionaires in India alone, but huge numbers of desperately poor people. So the diversity, the inequality is immense.
And haven't some people said that the country is going through an American-style robber baron era?
Yeah, there's one thing you can't miss if you sit in India today, and that's coverage of corruption, scandals that are so big that it would shame the most egregious Russian oligarch you could think of. But the scandals here are measured in the tens of billions of dollars stolen or revenues lost. And that's something that's helped to erode confidence in politicians. It's helped to paralyze the government, and it undermines the case for those who want to say, let's have more market reforms, because in the eyes of too many Indians, reforms means corruption, and that's a very, very dangerous combination of attitudes to put together.
Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has just turned 80 years old. He's been in power since 2004. Does the public still like him?
Well, we just saw an opinion poll tonight saying that the public is not very impressed with the Prime Minister here. I think they like him personally. He seems quite a humble, a quite considerate man, but nobody thinks he has the decisiveness, the sense of leadership that India needs. He was more decisive when he was finance minister 20 years ago, and maybe in the last couple of weeks he's shown a bit more boldness, the sort of thing we haven't seen for years. But as you said, he's 80 now, and people don't really expect him to be around much longer.
And as finance minister, he's credited with starting the economic boom or helping to facilitate it?
Yeah, that's right. In 1991, India faced a much more serious economic crisis than today, and it was forced partly by outside institutions like the IMF and the World Bank to go ahead and go for some economic reforms that eventually unleashed all the growth that India was enjoying. But the man who guided the country through that, arguably more than anyone else, was Manmohan Singh when he was the finance minister.
Haven't many of his ministers been accused of corruption, some even fired? Has he been linked to any of them, any of the scandals?
Well, not him personally. I mean, he was officially the Minister of Coal when there was a very big scandal in the coal sector. But most people think that he as an individual is very clean, a very honorable man, a very decent man. But on the other hand, when you preside over a government and you tolerate such immense levels of corruption among those people around you, then it starts to raise questions about your own sense of probity.
But despite that, you write, making political predictions in India is risky. Is his party likely to retain power heading into the 2014 election?
I think that there's no doubt that Congress will see reduced support. I think Congress at the moment is very unpopular among ordinary Indians. The corruption scandals, the slowing economy and so on means that Congress will get less support than it had last time around in 2009. But the great unknown in Indian politics is who will rise instead. The opposition parties, the rise of regional parties, it's not clear who will benefit when Congress suffers. So although we might say with some confidence that Congress will do badly or do worse in 2014, it gets harder then when you say, well, who's going to do well? Who will step in and fill the gap? And the greatest fear for India is that you have a fracturing of politics, a splitting up, and lots of smaller parties, and all they will care about is how to get hold of and hold on to power, and nobody will be thinking about how to rule well and how to give India the leadership that it desperately needs.
Well, before Congress regained power, the country was headed by the BJP, the Hindu Nationalist Party, and they were also beset by scandals. So is this endemic to Indian politics?
Well, as you said before, there's this sense that India is going through a robber baron phase, and that comes with a great rise in commodity prices, a great rush for getting control of valuable resources like land or mineral resources or telecom spectrum. And of course, politicians are at the center of that, and every party has its scandals just about. So there's no reason to hope that the corruption just goes away because you change the party in power. If you want to get rid of corruption in India, you've got to do much more basic things like improve the power of the courts, make funding of parties transparent, and that sort of thing. So just changing the party won't solve India's problems.
Do you believe that a growing urbanized and educated middle class will begin to change those dynamics?
That's the great hope for India, that gradually Indians get more educated, they urbanize, they get more sophisticated, better informed, both by the media, by their education, but also by new laws on rights to information and so on. And so you have this more sophisticated electorate, a well-informed, and if you've ever been to India, you'll know how articulate and how strong the sort of Indian individual can be. And so I think we'll see a very strong democracy emerging in time over generations, but it's how long that will take that is the uncertainty in India. It could be a question of decades, not years.
Does caste still count in Indian politics?
Yes, it does immensely, and I think it's one of the sadnesses of being here, that clearly there are many, many people who are defined by their caste or by some other form of identity, whether it's religion or their sort of personal background. And breaking through that is still very hard to do. Where you see it easiest to break through is in the cities and among the most educated people. But you don't have to go far. You don't have to go far from where I'm sitting right now in Delhi, and you can find whole villages of people who seem to be condemned to poverty or to repression merely on the basis of their caste identity.
You write that India's cities, by and large, are charmless and badly put together. Does that make moving to them unattractive to many Indians?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why India has grown much more slowly on its urban side. China is a much more urban country than India. Most countries are more urban than India. Two-thirds of the population still live in villages. And it's partly because the government tries to keep people in villages, but it's partly because the cities are really not welcoming. And only slowly, in the last 10 years especially, have policies started to change and have cities started to be managed in a way that would make it a more attractive place to live. But I think that's all part of what India has to do to develop better. It has to get its cities and its towns working much, much better than they have done so far.
Well, development in China has led to all sorts of environmental concerns. Is that true in India as well?
That's clearly true here as well. Anywhere where you have very rapid economic growth and maybe a lack of respect for the environmental laws, of course you're going to have problems. But when I've been out reporting in India, for example, I went hiking in Kashmir, and along with 600,000 Hindu pilgrims, and we hiked together towards this sacred Hindu cave in Kashmir, the environmental destruction on the way was devastating, and it was very sorry to see. And when I came back to Delhi and I talked to people about this, the discussions led to this idea that maybe too many people in India don't have a sense of public good, a respect for the commons. It's the question of the tragedy of the commons, that too much of northern India especially, it's far too common to pollute even the areas that you most revere and venerate. So if you're religious, you'll still damage the places you go to pray. And that's something that really has to change to improve the future of India.
And doesn't Kashmir also represent another kind of flashpoint? It still might lead to another war with Pakistan, and I'm assuming the military budget takes a big chunk out of the Indian economy.
It's not enormous. India doesn't spend an abnormal amount on its army and its military forces. But yes, Kashmir is still a very, very contentious area. Things have improved in the last 2 or 3 years. It's really calmed down. You have a million tourists a year going to Kashmir these days, mostly Indian tourists. And so the tension in that bit of the country has really calmed down. But you're quite right. At any moment, from either side, that border conflict, that competition with Pakistan for who would get to control that area could be ignited at any time. So it's a great concern to get that right and to try and solve that.
We're talking about the state of India today with Adam Roberts of The Economist. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Adam, analysts often compare the Chinese and Indian government models. China is a one-party state. India is a raucous democracy. Although I've been hearing recently that they've been cracking down on dissidents in India as well. But do you think that the fact that China has that top-down control has made control of the economy actually a little easier?
Yeah, I think in the short term it's very tempting to think that's true. Among the many problems that India has with developing fast is, for example, getting hold of land. If you want to build a road or put up a factory or just do anything that's economically valuable, the basic building block is to get the land to do your work on. Now, in China, if the political forces decide they're going to do something, they can just go and take the land. They can build a very straight road between two big cities, and the road will go through your village however much you complain. In India, there are very strong courts. There's a very strong respect for property. There's a very vociferous media. Every road in India wiggles and bends because you cannot build a straight road where everybody can fight over their property rights as hard as anyone could in Britain or America. Now, in the short term, that looks problematic for India. It makes it harder for investors. It makes it harder to get economic growth. But I would argue, and The Economist would argue, that in the long term, those sorts of institutions, the respect for law, the respect for courts and so on, are what would make India a much stronger and safer bet in the long term to develop and be robust in the future.
And another thing you point out that is working well is cell phone reception. We're speaking to you from Delhi. I don't know if you're on a cell phone, but this is a very good connection.
It's not always this good.
But yeah, some things are working well.
Some things are working well. And one story I like to tell is I took a train ride from the far, far north of India, from near the border with China, a four-day train ride over 3,000 or 4,000 kilometers from the far north of India to the very southern pointy tip, the sharp pointy tip at the bottom of India. And through that entire train ride, I had a secure, good quality mobile phone connection. And I thought, you know, if I can travel the length and breadth of India and have a better phone connection than I used to have back in Britain, something is working well.
Although there were blackouts this summer, so the power grid still has problems.
There are. If you were here in the height of the monsoon when it was getting very hot and very sweaty, and then we lost power for 2 days, it was clear that there are problems with infrastructure. The problem there, I'd argue, is that a lot of the infrastructure that failed in the summer was a problem of bureaucrats, of politicians, of state-run companies that were not efficiently run, whereas the mobile phones work very well because they're private and there are problems there too, but basically the service has to be better because the private companies will only make their money if the service works. And so the difference, the contrast was very striking between the failure to get power into people's homes to light their homes or to charge their mobile phones, but the fact that everybody could still use their mobile phones to complain about it.
The Times of India reports that the monsoon season has been erratic. Is that going to influence agriculture?
It's improved a bit. We were very worried about a month and a half ago that the monsoon would be as bad as the one back in 2009, which was the worst in 40 years. In fact, it turned out to be a late monsoon, and so we've had a lot of late rain. There are floods in the northeast at the moment, but the rain is helping to recharge the aquifers and to obviously water the fields. But India has a great problem with the monsoon and with irrigating its fields, because far too little of its farmers' fields is actually irrigated by canals or by any sort of irrigation system. Huge proportions of India's farmers still rely on the rain falling from the sky, and they do nothing to channel that or to collect it or to store it. And so there are structural investments that should be made to improve farming. And it could really improve a great deal more.
In places like China, there's a lot of talk about building up internal consumption capacity, that is, getting the Chinese to buy more of their own goods and products. Is something similar happening in India?
Well, I think India is a more domestically driven economy than China, so you have quite a strong pattern of consumption already in India. I think what India would like to do is almost the opposite of China. India would like to build up a stronger export capacity. It's very good at exporting services, the sort of outsourcing that it's famous for in America. But what India doesn't do very well is exporting manufactured goods. And it would be very good for India's economy, for the balance of the economy, if India were better at doing some of that manufacturing, some of that factory work that not only China does, but other countries like Vietnam and Bangladesh are becoming quite good at doing.
Wasn't there hope for the auto industry in that regard? What happened?
The auto industry is doing well. Not the famous Tata Nano. Do you remember the mini little car that was going to be, everybody could afford it? That car hasn't really worked. But generally, India's car industry is quite robust and has done well. So that's one bright bit of the manufacturing sector. But otherwise, India's manufacturers don't really succeed.
Wasn't there a spat recently about whether or not the country should let foreign supermarkets open stores in India?
That's completely right. That's the big political debate at the moment. The the government of Manmohan Singh has said in the last couple of weeks, let's open up, let's let in companies like Walmart come from America, and we'll have supermarkets, foreign supermarkets in India. Now, that's very unpopular among ordinary Indians. They fear that the foreign supermarkets will come in and somehow destroy their businesses. But the state of retail in India is really not very good. 30 to 40% of the fruit and vegetables grown here rots and is lost and is wasted before it gets to the consumers. And the hope would be that professional companies, better capitalized companies like Walmart, could improve that and could improve the experience for consumers and for farmers in India. But it's a very controversial issue in a country that still is not comfortable with sort of red meat capitalism.
And that also applies to the recent efforts to cut fuel subsidies.
Yeah.
Why do some analysts think that kind of reform is important and needed?
Well, India has been spending beyond its means. That's obviously familiar for anyone who's been looking at many countries around the world. But India in the last couple of years especially has been very generous with its spending, keeping fuel artificially cheap, giving people very cheap food rations, other forms of subsidies for fertilizer and so on. And basically, as the economy has slowed, the government doesn't have the means to pay for this. And so the most obvious and most necessary thing to do is to put up the price of fuel to something more like the market rate. But you can imagine, if you're an ordinary consumer in India, if you're getting on the bus in the morning or you're filling up your car or trying to pay for anything, when diesel goes up by 12 to 14%, that really hits you straight away. And so it's a very unpopular move, but a necessary one.
Well, has India made the psychological transition from being a controlled economy to a more free market economy?
I think it's only halfway there. The big reforms of 1991 really did transform India. It helped to shift expectations of what India should be. And we can see across a whole range of areas that India is becoming a more kind of westernized place. But ordinary Indians, especially those two-thirds of the population who live in villages, are not really ready yet for the full-throttle capitalism that we might be used to in America or in Europe. And so there's a great clutching to social provision, to state-run companies, to handouts from the state, to make-work schemes that were much more familiar to people who were growing up in India in the 60s and 70s. And so your question is spot on. Indians are not yet ready to make the turn in the way that, say, China has done towards a more capitalist economy.
Adam Roberts' special report on India in The Economist called Aim Higher has led us to this discussion of the state of India today. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.